I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. According to the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, every day in this country, 47 children and teens are shot, and every day, 7 of them die. Today, the search for common ground when it comes to protecting our kids from guns and gun violence. We'll bring you excerpts from the American Public Square event that brought together Second Amendment supporters, including those who call for common sense steps to keep children safe from guns. Then, tomorrow marks 17 years since planes flew into the towers at the World Trade Center. What are today's students, a whole generation that has grown up in the shadow of terrorism, being taught about 9/11? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Last Thursday, KCUR and Up to Date teamed with American Public Square to present Up in Arms, Kids and Guns. With KCUR's Dan Margulies serving as the roving reporter, I moderated a 90-minute panel discussion on a hot-button issue that tested the square's civility rules. I think you'll understand why in this edited version. Let's meet the guests.
Karen Randolph Rogers is deputy chapter lead and statewide legislative lead for the Missouri chapter of Moms Demand Actions for Gun Sense in America. Dr. Shayla Sullivan is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Children's Mercy Hospital. She's also an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Then Robert Verbruggen, he's deputy managing editor of the National Review. Robert has covered Second Amendment and gun policy issues for more than a decade. A Second Amendment proponent, he also appears on NRA TV. And finally, Kevin Jameson is an attorney and author of Missouri Weapons and Self-Defense Law. He writes and speaks on law, personal security, and firearms-related issues. He's a member of the National Rifle Association. He's a graduate of the UMKC School of Law. Let's give our panel a round of applause for being here tonight. Okay, let's get going here. Let me come to you, Dr. Sullivan.
Sure.
In your experience, what are the primary causes of gun injuries or deaths in children?
So for kids, what we know is that unintentional injuries are more common with the younger children. So that's kids playing with a gun, a loaded gun. And for the older kids, what we see is homicides and suicides. So having access to firearms, particularly loaded firearms, are what lead to deaths often.
You know, are the factors, considerations different for young children versus teenagers, doctor?
Kids are curious, right? And there's this idea that children can be taught to not touch a gun. But kids can tell us, yes, I know I shouldn't touch a gun. But we have quite a few research studies showing that when kids are left alone in a room with a bunch of toys and a real gun, that they're very likely to pick up that gun and play with it. And many of them will actually fire the gun or point it at a friend. And then with adolescents, when they're struggling with suicidal thoughts, they're very impulsive. I've interviewed hundreds of kids that have survived suicide attempts. And when I ask them, when did you decide to do this? What they tell me is, what do you mean, when I did it? So if they have quick access to a very lethal method, they're more likely to die.
Robert Verbruggen, how would you define the problem of firearms injuries and deaths in children and youth?
I think one thing that we really need to emphasize here is that the sheer level of the problem is just completely different. If you look in the CDC data, gun deaths for the kids 10 and under are actually roughly in the vicinity of 0.4 per 100,000, where in the teenagers it just skyrockets upward. And by the time you hit 17, you're looking at more like 10 per 100,000. I think what that means is that when we're talking about preventing gun deaths among minors, the biggest focus really has to be among the teenagers and what they're doing, because that's just such a much higher rates.
Karen, let me come to you. As a volunteer for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, what problem are you trying to address here?
We believe that the Second Amendment is something we can support. We believe that responsible gun ownership and storage education is important, and we do that in the community with our Be Smart for Kids program. And we talk about the risks of unsecured firearms, and we talk about how people can be smart for gun safety, and that's for anybody who's around children. But we also do believe that part of the equation is there is something more that can be done in terms of stronger gun laws.
Kevin Jameson, again, attorney and author of Missouri Weapons and Self-Defense Law. Does Missouri have laws restricting the access of children to guns?
Yes. There are some state laws which prohibit juveniles under the age of 18, 17 years old and younger from possessing firearms, unless, and there's an exception for the farm kids who are out on the family's back 40. The bad guys are not allowed to have guns. Crazy people are not allowed to have guns. Domestic violence abusers are not allowed to have guns.
Can they not go to a gun show to buy them?
Right.
No. Places where they don't have background
checks? It is still against the law. There is no extraterritorial right in a gun show to buy a gun. And if you went to a gun show and the dealers are on the phone calling the FBI to see if the guy is legally able to buy a gun.
Robert, do you want to weigh in here?
If you're a felon and you're one of the prohibited people named in federal law, it is illegal for you to buy a gun from anyone. The problem, though, is that we have laws for the gun dealers. If a gun dealer, if you make a living selling guns, you need to get a license and you need to do a background check for every person you sell the gun to. But if I, you know, if I decide I don't want my gun anymore, I can go and sell it to whoever I want. The problem, I'm not allowed to knowingly sell it to somebody who lives in another state or somebody who's a felon, but I don't have to, there's nothing saying that I have to investigate that person. I don't have to make sure that they're not a felon. So that's where I think some of the confusion comes in, because it is still illegal for that transaction to take place. It's illegal for the felon to break the law, but it may not be illegal for the seller to sell it to them.
We're talking about kids and guns here on Up to Date. Dr. Sullivan from Children's Mercy Hospital, you wanted
yes.
to dive in here.
One thing we really need to focus on tonight is remembering that the kids that are dying with firearms, the majority of them are not dying because of bad guys. The kids that are dying with guns often are shooting themselves. I'm saying the majority of them are finding guns within their own homes. So I think we need to talk about that, and we need to think about not only protecting the children in our community, but the firearm owners too, because they're unsuspecting often that this is a potential in their own homes. I just had this conversation with a parent at the hospital today whose daughter got a revolver for Christmas, and I asked how it was stored, and she said, you know, I'm not worried about my daughter and suicide. And I said, I hear you. Most kids are not going to be suicidal, but when I put on my seatbelt in the morning, I don't expect to get in a car accident that day. But I do it anyway because I know that it could save my life. And I think about guns that way too. They're a part of our community, and that's not going to change. But I think how we manage them could really make a difference.
Karen.
One of the things that our Be Smart program talks about with parents too is that even if you think you're doing everything in your home to keep your kids safe, it's really important to ask about the presence of unsecured firearms in the other places where your child is going to be. I had a play date yesterday, took my kids to a neighbor's house, and you know, it may seem like it's an awkward, hard thing to do, but you would ask about, if your child had a life-threatening peanut allergy, you would ask about peanuts in that house. I ask about, if you own firearms, do you store them locked and separately from ammunition? And every single parent that I've ever asked has always been so grateful that I asked. But that is an important conversation to have.
I want to go to a question for Robert Verbruggen again, Deputy Managing Editor of the National Review. The homicide rate by firearms for black youth is much higher than for white, and the suicide rate by firearms is much higher for white youth than for black. Are these two separate issues that call for very different responses here?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the homicide issue and the suicide issue, I think they're very, very different in terms of policy response. I've written a lot about ways that we can control gun violence in terms of homicide without resorting to, you know, really strict gun control measures. And this has a lot to do with policing. It has a lot to do with building trust in these communities between the police and the community. And it has to do with folk, you know, figuring out who the social networks are where the violence is happening and figuring out where the hot spots are for violence and having the police and other social workers and things like that get involved in that part of the community and really work to bring down the violence level. Whereas with suicide, as I think we've discussed, this is, a lot of times this is parents who haven't secured their guns, and it's really as simple as lock up your gun if you have a minor in the house.
Yeah. Dan Margulies.
Can you comment on a strategy to encourage responsible gun storage by charging a parent or guardian when their gun is used by their child in a shooting?
Kevin, run at that.
I've had cases like this. And when you look at a family that the family gun has been used in an accident or a deliberate crime, to think that they need more punishment is frankly insane. There is, as the doctor mentions, that the tragedy in that family is beyond belief. There are ways to fix this. We teach safe storage. You can get this information usually for free. And it's aimed at various age levels. If you contact the NRA, they put you in touch with a local gun safety instructor, and the instructor will come and tell your group, this is what you should be doing. When I say we, the NRA, I guess, has been teaching this since 1871.
This notion of a fine or a penalty, Dr. Sullivan, what would you say about this?
I have similar concerns in punishing people that are grieving. And yet, I think we need to get people on board with safe storage, like you're saying, but how, right? They don't want to hear a psychiatrist tell them to do it, but how do we get firearm owners on board with that? I think that $10 tickets for seatbelts, not wearing your seatbelt, was impactful and got a lot of people to wear their seatbelts, but we're not going to go into people's homes, right, and check how they store their firearms. So it's a very complex issue.
Robert, what's your answer?
I basically agree that once, after the fact, once something like this has happened, I don't think you're punishing them anymore by doing that. But the one thing that gives me a little bit of pause on that is that the RAND Corporation put together this really fantastic roundup of gun research within about the past year. One of the things they found was that one of the few areas where we actually have fairly strong conclusions is with child access laws. The RAND report is actually very exacting in its scientific standards, and I do wonder if that is part of the solution, is to just have a law that you have to do it and to enforce it. And it might not be fair to do it to people who've just had a tragedy in their family, but I think it might send the message to other people.
Karen, you were trying to get in here too.
We call these child access prevention laws, and I do think that can be part of the equation. It may not always be a parent that's negligently handled that gun. It can be another adult. We may want to think about that could be a possible issue. But what I do think the primary focus should be is on the gun safety education. And our focus is entirely on making sure that adults understand that they are the ones that are responsible for making sure the kid doesn't get to that point.
You're shaking your head. Why?
Our problem with the laws promoted by Moms Demand is that they're demanding that we lock up guns as one-size-fits-all solution. And that's not the way the world works.
Okay, and Karen, you're shaking your head.
I do want to emphasize that owning a gun is a personal decision. And so any family that wants to own a gun, certainly you want to have access to the gun. And I think that Kevin and I agree that there are a range of options. I mean, we're not a one-size-fits-all. There are gun locks. There are biometric safes where you can use a fingerprint and access that gun. But we do believe that you need to secure your guns locked and separate from ammunition, because that's the only way that you're going to be able to ensure that your children are safe.
Dan Margulies.
Here's a question that I think Dr. Sullivan might be the one we want to direct this to. Are doctors allowed to ask if there are guns in the home? And if not, can they give their patients a brochure of some kind instructing them on how to store them safely?
The courts have ruled that yes, we can, particularly because this impacts the care that we provide our patients. You know, we talk to our patients about many different intimate details of their lives in order to assure their safety and provide healthy recommendations. We've had a 60% increase nationally in firearm suicides for young people. So yes, it is legal to ask. I will tell you, there's been a good study that came out that said that 75% of parents felt like it was appropriate for pediatricians to provide firearm counseling. I'm concerned about that 25% that didn't like it, because I want to reach the parents, right? There's a lot of reasons why people may not feel comfortable with their doctor talking about firearms in the office. So I've changed my approach, and I've stopped asking, because I don't need the parent worrying that I'm putting it in the chart. So I just provide universal education, and I say firearms are very common in our community, so I make these recommendations for everybody that I work with because of XYZ, and I go through it. And often people interrupt me and say, oh, we don't have guns in our house, and I say, okay, well, maybe grandpa does, or neighbors, or friends, but I can still provide the education. We should be addressing firearms because it's such a public safety issue.
Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say I think that's a good approach. And my own experience with my doctor, we get this fact sheet. It has to make some sort of political statement about how the safest thing is not to have the gun in your house. And then the doctor is asking me if I have a gun, and I want to lie, but my wife won't let me. It's that defensive reflex. And
yeah.
It's just incredibly frustrating. It puts people on the defensive. And I think if you just say, hey, if you have a gun, your kid is three, he's getting strong enough where he can, you know, pull a trigger. Kids are morons. Lock it up if you have it. That makes a lot more sense to me than the sort of really frustrating experience that I think a lot of gun owners have with doctors.
Karen, do you want to jump in?
I agree. And one of the things we do think can be helpful is kind of making the Be Smart information universally available to parents, whether it's through the American Academy of Pediatrics website. I've taken Be Smart cards to my own pediatrician, and she's distributing them at well visits, posters. People can just passively view that information and go to the website. I do think that physicians can be a very important ally in keeping kids safe that way.
Yeah, we actually give away free gun locks at Children's Mercy, and we have for a while now. So you just have to walk by the security desk and ask for one, and they don't take down your name or anything, because we think it's that important that we secure guns.
Jack Altman of Lawrence, Kansas asks this question. If bad guys can always get a gun, making more restrictions unproductive, how is it that countries with stringent gun restrictions like Australia or Great Britain and others have not witnessed the kind of mass gun violence we have in the United States?
Robert, you look eager.
I can take that one on. First of all, I think it's the disparity between the U.S. and other countries in terms of gun violence goes way back. This isn't something that just happened when, you know, Australia passed its gun control or Britain passed its gun control. And if you look at the charts of the violence in these countries before and after they passed their gun control laws, they're not as compelling as what you get, I think, from a lot of the liberal writing on this. I encourage you to look at that RAND Corporation report, because they did have a chapter in that about whether there's a correlation between crime and gun prevalence and the difficulties of studying that. I don't believe necessarily that the guns are the root of this problem. I think we have a higher overall homicide rate, not globally, but just if you compare us with the very most developed countries. I think that goes back to a lot of things in our history and our culture, you know, the sort of this culture of honor in the South. We have this horrendous racial history and these dramatic racial disparities in firearm violence. I think it's far too simple to just point at it and say guns, and everybody knows that if you just get rid of the guns, you solve the problem, because I don't think that's true.
Kevin, what would you add to that?
We have a violent history. We are a violent people. And I'm sorry, but that's the way history reads. That's just the way our people have always been. The countries that have adopted severe restrictions have not reduced their overall murder rate.
Sheila, what about this notion that we're a violent people? What would you say in response to that?
I totally disagree with that. And part of that is just based off of my education and my experience of attending conferences with international psychiatrists, right? So when you read the literature, you don't see that we are a people full of vengeance and aggression. What you see is that when we are full of vengeance and aggression, or when we are desperate and suicidal, we have quicker access to very powerful machines that kill ourselves or others. So that, to me, is the big difference. I mean, if you look at the Israeli Defense Force, they reduced their suicide rate by 40%. How did they do that? They didn't let the soldiers take the firearms home on the weekends. So access is really big. When someone is in the heat of anger or desperation, if they don't have quick access to a very lethal method, they're less likely to die. So if you take away the most lethal method, even if someone substitutes something less lethal, like, for example, a knife in a homicide, we have many fewer people dying of homicides with knives, right? We could all agree upon that. So even if you take away the most lethal, you have less deaths.
Would arming teachers in schools make kids safer?
Kevin?
Well, actually, it has happened. Pearl, Mississippi, a psychopath who killed his mother and stole her guns, shot up the high school. The vice principal ran to his car, which was parked off campus because there was a gun in it, and ran back, and the kid was headed for the junior high school with a loaded rifle, a lever-action rifle, actually. And the vice principal pointed a gun at him, said, "Halt," and one of the rare instances where these guys surrendered rather than committing suicide.
I'd like to respond.
Karen?
If that's okay. We are in a society where we're very concerned about protecting our schools, but we don't think the answer is hardening our schools. Teachers are being asked to address all sorts of societal ills, and they're not equipped to do it. I actually went to Jefferson City this year, and in part of my group, we had a retired educator, and she looked a state senator dead in the eye and said, "I don't care who it is. I don't think I could shoot a student. Even if that student was a person who might be a threat, I don't think I could do that." To ask them to put that burden on themselves when they're already trying to meet so much in the classroom is just an unreasonable expectation. I know that if I were personally in a school district where the district decided to do that, I would move out of that district. And I've actually let our superintendent know that proactively.
You know, regardless of how you feel about this issue, how close are we to seeing teachers armed with guns on a broader scale? Robert, do you have any feel for that?
There are some states where it's already legal. There are some groups that do it. You know, I personally don't have a problem with it if people are trained properly. I mean, we don't have a problem with, you know, security guards having guns in schools or police having guns in schools. And if the teachers, you know, want to do this and are trained properly and the community is okay with that, I don't have a problem with it. I don't see that being widely accepted.
We have teachers who are buying their own school supplies. And it's amazing to think that we would have school districts that possibly lay out money to buy firearms and then train teachers to perform that skill when we have teachers buying their own school supplies.
You know, I'm just wondering, as we begin to wind down here, all of you have spent so much time looking at this issue. What's the road ahead? How do we come together and begin to formulate solutions that'll satisfy more people than are being satisfied today? Because, again, the sense is the country is pretty split here. How do we move ahead in a way that's more constructive than what we've seen the last few years? Robert, do you want to begin with that?
I mean, I'm not sure that we will. I think this is the kind of issue that goes in fits and starts. It goes back and forth depending on who's in political power. I mean, a lot of people were really hopeful about 10 years ago when the Heller decision came out that it would kind of bring the temperature down, because now we have the Supreme Court saying, you know, you can't just outright ban guns. You can't require people, you know, if they own a gun, to completely disassemble it and have it completely inaccessible to them. And I just don't see that that's happened. I just don't know. To me, it's just purely a question of which side has control of Congress and which side has control of the state legislatures. I'm not sure that there's a kumbaya moment in the works here.
Doctor?
I think that's part of the problem, is that this is seen as a left and a right issue. This is seen as a partisan issue. If you went into my history, I grew up in a home with guns, and my dad had guns for hunting and for protection, and I went to the farm and learned how to shoot a gun, but I'm not an expert on guns, and I'm a psychiatrist who's really concerned about access to guns because of the deaths in our country for young people. So what does that make me? Am I anti-gun? Am I pro-gun? I think many of us don't fit perfectly in a bucket. I think many of us feel like we've got to work together on this and we've got to talk about it. I really feel like we need to learn more from the firearm owners about what solutions are acceptable, because I understand people say, listen, I need to have quick access to my gun. Okay, so then is it the fingerprint safe? What is it? But how do we limit access? Because I hear everybody up here tonight agreeing that we want to limit access for vulnerable, impulsive young people. That's huge. That could save thousands of lives every year in our country if we could figure that out. So I disagree. I'm totally all about it. I think we just need to keep talking and working together and motivating people, and I think we can, but I think we need firearm owners at the table talking to people that want to work on it together.
Karen?
I agree that we've got a lot more agreement on this than we're led to believe. I mean, depending on the survey, between 91 and 95% of Americans support universal background checks. So I don't think there are some of these things where we have a disconnect, frankly, between what the public wants and where our elected leaders are. And so really what the solution is if we don't have elected leaders who represent our interests, we have to vote them out. When you look at popular support, they are not controversial fixes. In response to Parkland, we have just seen a tremendous outpouring of an expectation that our leaders do something. We have seen that most compellingly from the people who are most affected by these mass shootings, these students. And I, for one, have been very inspired by their voices. And as they become voters and become active in our politics, I think that is going to help move us.
Kevin, how do you see the road ahead in making this debate more constructive and leading to solutions that more people can live with?
To make it more constructive, well, if you want to have us come in and show you what can be done to keep your kids safe, we'll do it. We'll do it for free. We'll show you what materials we have, and you can decide if it's good for you, and then you'll find out something about us. I think that would be very helpful. But for not being anti-gun, there's not one pro-gun objective that the people on my right have supported. They've resisted every reform we've tried to do. And I think if we're really going to work together, they need to decide what guns and what use of guns they are never going to come after. And if somebody else comes after them, are they going to stand with us and protect those guns? And lastly, why should I believe them?
Okay. You've held it in all evening. Let's give our panel a very good round of applause for coming here tonight.
You just heard excerpts from last week's American Public Square that examined Up in Arms, Kids and Guns. Coming up, how the events of 9/11 are taught to the generation that came in its wake. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we learned about the different senior living options that exist. There are a whole bunch. And we discuss how to make the best housing and care decisions for yourself or for a loved one. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, a conversation with Congressman Kevin Yoder. He'll be joining us in studio for a one-on-one conversation on his re-election campaign in his race against Democratic challenger Sharice Davids. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it may be hard to believe, but there's now a generation of kids going through high school and college who weren't alive or weren't old enough to remember the September 11 terrorist attacks. Turns out that some history teachers recognize they have a new challenge before them, how to teach about the events of that horrific day that goes beyond the superficial. After all, the attacks led to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that resulted in the creation of the controversial Patriot Act, and there were now new questions about civil liberties, radical Islam, and Islamophobia. According to one recent survey, only about 20 states include anything in depth about the events of that fateful day in their high school social studies curriculum. So how to teach it? American history teacher Jeanette Jones is attempting to do just that from her perch at Pembroke Hill. She teaches 10th grade modern world history and 11th grade U.S. history. And Jeanette, what a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, some folks think that a number of years have to pass before the history of an event can be written with any accuracy and sense of context. Does the same apply to the events of September 11th?
No, I would say not, because students are engaged in these events all the time. Instead of teaching it as a current event necessarily, you look at an event like 9/11 from a personal perspective. You ask them to interview their parents, talk to their parents about this event, and that allows them to get into some of the details without having to wait 50 years.
Now, why did you decide to take on this topic to begin with? Because you're biting off a mouthful here.
It's important that students understand the history of their own lifetime. That way they are able to contextualize other events in history. So it was important that we start the year with talking about their own history, so then they can see more objectively what is going on in their day-to-day lives.
You know, I was struck. So many schools, according to national surveys, aren't even teaching anything or anything of substance about 9/11. Does that surprise you?
Not at all. Given the issue of testing, and particularly with APs and IBs, teachers have a lot to unpack with students. And teaching 9/11 in a thoughtful way takes a lot of time. And teachers just do not have time for those things.
And that says something about the state of teaching these days if standardized testing is preventing something like what you're talking about.
Right. We're still going through, the timeline of history continues, and yet we have less and less time to teach it. So that makes it difficult to unpack those special topics that you think students really should know.
We're talking about how to teach students about 9/11, students who weren't even alive when those events occurred. We're coming up on an anniversary here in just a couple of days. How are you approaching it then, Jeanette? Is it a separate class unto itself or part of an existing course? What are you doing?
I think that in my world history and my U.S. history class, it is part of the curriculum, but it's one of those topics that I begin the school year with in terms of unpacking the history of their lifetime. And then by the time, as far as the history timeline goes, is once we get to that time period, we circle back. And I want to know whether or not their ideas about this time has changed now that they've seen other history, and show how other histories have influenced what happens during 9/11.
How much interest do your kids have in these events? Is it more interesting because it's so recent?
It is very interesting because it's so recent. Also, it's one of those events that they can talk to their parents about because their parents witnessed it firsthand. They experienced it. Everyone knows where they were when 9/11 happened.
So this isn't World War I, where people who were there aren't around anymore today.
Exactly.
What kind of reaction did you get from parents of your students to the fact that you were teaching this history?
I think they find it very important, especially when I ask them to interview their parents for special projects or special assignments. It gives them a chance to really look at it generationally with parents versus grandparents' reaction versus their own reaction in terms of the world they live in now. They get a better understanding of the world around them.
You know, it strikes me that this topic could take up an entire semester in a college course. What are some of the topics that you take on? Because you don't have that much time. You got to take just a few bites of the apple here, right?
Right. So I look at it two perspectives. I look at the U.S. reaction and then I look at the global reaction. But I think it's important for students to understand who the perpetrators were. And so we sort of begin our conversation with who did this and why. And I keep it limited to bin Laden and al-Qaeda. I do not go and talk to about all these other issues. Unless it comes up in class, then I will address those. But I try to keep the students focused on the who and the why in the moment. And then we talk about our reaction, be it from the general public or government response.
How familiar are they about what happened that day?
They're not familiar with the day-to-day details. So it's important that to give them an idea, you take them through a timeline. So I give them an interactive timeline. The 9/11 Memorial website gives a really great timeline for that.
Did you actually show them the video of what occurred that day?
Yes, but only after we talk about it in general. I ask them what they remember, what do they think happened. I teach 9/11 based on where they are from, not what I think they should know in the moment, but I go from where they are starting and then I back it up. So it's usually not the first day I show them the video, even though they are familiar with it.
You know, you're sort of jarring me here a little bit because it's kind of amazing to me that there are people walking on this planet who, you know, don't remember the events of that day, kids in high school and college, but you're talking about a whole generation who weren't around when these events happened, so their familiarity of it is a little suspect then.
Yes, and it's okay. It's very okay that they're familiar, that they don't have much familiarity, because remember, in their lives, particularly in this world, they are very shielded from those events and what's going on in the world. They go about their day-to-day lives, and they don't have to encounter those horrific events on those days. When we look at the video, for example, we are all reminded of that day and where we were that day. For them, for a lot of them, it's new, and it's distant. And therefore, the impact is not the same.
I was going to say, how shocked are they when they watch the video of what occurred?
They are shocked because they've heard a lot about it. For those students who have seen it, it's just another video. It still surprises them. It still takes them aback. But for the most part, they have realized that this is not much different than any other event that I would show them in history.
Does it feel surreal to them? Do they have a hard time grasping the idea that something that horrific actually happened on American soil?
No, because before then, if you keep with the historical timeline, they've seen Pearl Harbor, and so they've seen those bombings. They see what happens there. We talk about the bombing in 93. So they know events, and we talk about Oklahoma in 95. So it's not that they haven't been familiarized with these ideas.
What do you say about the whole idea of Islamophobia, this notion that so many Americans reacted so negatively against anyone who's Muslim in this country or who was at that time? What do you say about that?
That's one of the issues that I have to address right off the bat. And I tell people that they have to really understand to separate the events. And that's why I focus on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And I don't talk about it in terms of Islam. Okay, but when students bring up Islamophobia, I do have to step back. I do have to give them an explanation of the religion and the pillars of faith and information that shows what the differences between the jihads and why it's important for us to separate these acts from the religion, because we would never do that in terms of Christianity or Judaism. So why would we do it in terms of Islam?
Teaching the events of September 11th to students who weren't alive when those events occurred. That's our topic. We'll see an anniversary of these events tomorrow here across the country. You know, just weeks after the attacks, Jeanette, Congress passed, with some Democratic opposition, the Patriot Act, which proved to be intensely controversial as the years passed. Critics pointed to the authorization of indefinite detentions of immigrants, the new ability of law enforcement officers to search a home or a business without the owner's or the occupant's consent, the new ability of the FBI to search telephone and financial records without a court order. Some of these provisions were later struck down in court. Where do you go with all of that?
Okay, so it's interesting because one of the things I ask my students first off is how much security are they willing to forego? You know, how much of their personal freedoms are they willing to give up in order to guarantee security? Now, early on when we start talking about 9/11, it was without question. Students were more than happy to give up a little bit freedom to maintain security. But in this day and age, with students who really don't understand life prior to 9/11, this whole idea of, you know, tapping into people's phones, especially since the invention of the new iPhone, they are very set against this encroachment of their freedoms at this time.
Yeah. And what do you say about that?
Well, I have to contextualize it as usual. I have to explain to them that under the circumstances of what was going on, the constant events, and then I ask them about what's going on in Europe, and do those events then also help justify the continuation of the Patriot Act, given that we, even though we are able to stop a lot of these acts before they happen, you know, is that because of the Patriot Act?
Mm-hmm.
And so I have them get in groups and debate whether or not our civil liberties is at stake and whether or not it's worth it, given the protection of so many people in this country.
But you're saying a lot of them are bothered by the fact they might see some of their privacy invaded. I thought you might say that maybe this new generation isn't nearly as concerned about it, given the fact they're being raised in a generation where hackings and the stealing of records, private records, is pretty commonplace.
Right. But at the same time, you have to think about them and their personal ideas and their personal lives. They see all of this stuff going on, but that's not them. That's out there somewhere. That's not in their immediate world. Mm-hmm. In their immediate world, everything is supposed to be private, and locked down, and no one's supposed to have access to it. When it goes to other things in the wider world, then it's okay.
Yeah. How old, based on your experience, how old do you think students have to be to begin teaching them about 9/11 in something of a meaningful way?
I would argue middle school, without question, in terms of talking about how our lives in this country have changed as a consequence of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be taught in the broader context of things before and after 9/11.
Yeah. What questions do your students have as they watch the video, as you begin to dive into this subject? What do they want to talk about?
They want to talk about the why. Why did this happen? Why did they do it? What's our government response? Was our government response enough? I mean, right now we're still dealing with the consequences of 9/11.
We're still at war.
We're still at war. And they want to know how long. Why can't we stop this? What can we do? I mean, the biggest question is, what can we do to prevent or to lessen the impact of this?
What can we do?
Well, educate. That's my big mantra, and contextualize. It's very important that we tell them the events, tell them why these things happen, give them the information so they can make a decision as to what this means for them and why this happens. One of the exercises that I do about this is I ask the students, is how should we teach 9/11? Why is it important that we still do it? I let them wrestle with those questions, because a textbook is going to provide a particular point of view from the particular author who wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to understand that history isn't that static, and that history is very fluid, and that we can add to the narrative and change the direction and the ideas of history. So I think education is the best form to change things.
Is there much in the way of textbook information, reliable textbook information on this subject?
Oh, yes. All the textbooks, at least that we use, are updated with the basic information. But I also think it's important that we go to the newspapers, that we read the information during that time to get op-eds and have the students parse out what people were feeling in the moment, but also read a lot of the articles that look at the retrospective and what does 9/11 mean 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later, and what that means, so that they can begin to historicize it But also understanding that, you know, in this day and age, it's still with us every day because of the wars we're still fighting and because of airport security.
Yeah, airport security. Just went through it this weekend. Still don't like it. Let's go to some phone calls here. Jerome from Prairie Village. Jerome, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, does the timeline that you have go back to Osama bin Laden fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan?
My timeline certainly does. As a historian, I think history is crucial. Yes.
So the one you teach the students does go back that far.
Yes, because even if I focus on the 911 Memorial Interactive site, I have my own timeline that goes all the way back. And I talk about Afghanistan in a way that students wouldn't even imagine Afghanistan to be. In the 70s, it was modern, and it was not the Afghanistan that we imagine it to be today.
Thank you for taking my question. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Jerome. Let's go to Jesse from Kansas City, Missouri. Jesse, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon, you guys. I just had a question. Seeing if she was using testimonies or eyewitness accounts of people that were at or in the building and worked at the World Trade Centers the day of the attack, if that was actually included in the teachings, basically, because there's multiple different accounts and good eyewitness testimonies of bombs being in the building, and I just wanted to know if that's actually being in the part of the process as well.
For me,
thank you for taking my question.
Yeah, you
sure.
Bet.
For me, what I usually rely on is I rely on a lot of PBS documentaries on 9/11, and they have a lot of firsthand testimony that we use. I also use a lot of newspaper articles to add to that firsthand testimony, because I believe that that narrative, that first-person account, is extremely important, and it's a way that I help students use how to use primary sources in their analysis.
Are you able to answer all their questions, or does this stuff come up that even stumps a veteran teacher like Jeanette Jones?
No, yeah. I can't answer all their questions. I don't try to answer all their questions because part of this is to give them the tools that they need to get some of those questions answered for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my job to give them a one position narrative on 9/11. They need to come up with their own narrative on 9/11. Because it is different for everyone, because we were all impacted in different ways.
Some of this, I imagine, has got to shake these kids a little bit. I mean, it's so real, it's so raw, it's so recent that I'm just wondering how they process it and if they walk away fearful.
No, that was one of the things that I really hoped to do, is actually to, you know, have them become more hopeful in the end. And that in a world where we can connect with these devices that we have now, that we can make the world smaller, that we can connect on more of a personal level and use that to overcome a lot of prejudices that will help us move beyond this and hopefully prevent another one from happening.
Do you think that's happening?
I think it is happening because, for example, my school, we have lots of exchange students from all over the world. In the last couple of years, I've had the pleasure of having students from the Middle East in my classrooms, and we talk about 9/11. We talk about the impact in their home countries. We talk about it here. And we know that it is a matter of just exchanging with people, meeting with people, seeing people, having that connection with people that are different from you. And that changes things.
And the risk, Jeanette, if we don't approach this topic in classrooms across the country, then is what?
I think the problem is that we're going to end up repeating the same cycle over and over again. And that's one of the things, that mantra is true. If you do not study your history, you are doomed to repeat it. And it's important that we understand the context in which events happen, not just that things happen, but the context in which they happen. And I think that's the difficult part about teaching history. It's not the events, it's the context, and willing to open up that box and dig into those with the students. And it's hard for them to do it. And we know that it's hard, but it's one of the most important things that we do as educators in order to make things better as we move forward.
That's Jeanette Jones. She's a history teacher at Pembroke Hill. Thanks for coming in. I want to come sit in your classroom sometime. Sounds fascinating.
Thank you. Anytime, Steve.
You bet. Again, Jeanette Jones from Pembroke Hill. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow on the show, tune in for a conversation about anonymous sources and the responsible use of the information or stories they can provide. Also, Congressman Kevin Yoder will be here in the studio with me. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.